It's sort of nice to be back on our bullshit.
Yeah, it is. Honestly, it's great.
Today I was like, oh, this is so nice. I'm reading this book. We're going to talk about this book. And then it's just going to be a normal episode. And I'm really happy that we're back.
Me too.
And I'm really happy that we read this book because I had forgotten how much I loved this book when I first read it.
Agreed.
But it is first person present.
I have some feelings about it, Sarah. You know what, though? Okay, let's introduce ourselves.
We should. Let's not get right in. Let's not dive right in.
Before we start off with my bullshit.
It's Thanksgiving week. How was your holiday? Wait, we need to introduce ourselves.
Welcome to Faded Mates, everyone. I'm Jennifer Prokop. I'm on task this morning in my romance reading and romance criticism ways.
Very focused. I'm Sarah McLean, deeply unfocused. And I write romance novels. I read romance novels. And this week we're reading Sally Thorne's The Hating Game.
We are, which was a beloved romance, hugely popular.
A juggernaut.
Yeah.
A juggernaut of a romance. And when we sort of started this season, what feels like a thousand years ago.
Because it was, obviously.
We said, you know, we were going to tackle sort of the modern romances that really have shaped the way romance looks right now in 2020. Yes. And I think that's really what's weird is over the last 8 months, it feels like strangely, like the world feels like it's standing still, but also like romance feels like there are sort of changes afoot. And so that's really interesting because at the beginning, The Hating Game was on our list from the beginning because sure. I think neither of us feel like you can really talk about romance
right now
over the last decade without name checking The Hating Game, right?
Right.
But right now it really does feel like something is happening in contemporaries. I don't know quite what, but it sure is happening. Anyway, we'll get to that. How was Thanksgiving?
It was very nice.
You ordered your food from a professional chef.
Whole Foods Market. Is its name?
Chef Whole Foods.
Chef Whole Foods. And you know what? It was delicious and it was fine. And it was just the three of us. And we had a really nice, quiet day. I have had all week off from work. So it's been really nice.
Delicious.
Yeah.
Well, I cooked a meal, which is, as you know, one of my favorite things to do.
Yes.
And I've been writing because we have no family here, which is, of course, sad, but also, like, I mean, I didn't realize that some people were so relaxed on holidays.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Yeah.
I would do this again. Don't tell anyone.
Yeah. You know, for us, it's sad, and I missed my family was together in Ohio, but this is my son's probably last year at home because he goes away to college. I mean, you know, like, hopefully, I hope he'll be home at Thanksgiving.
That's it. They never come back.
Sure, obviously.
That.
But it did feel like a kind of a gift to just have that time with him. To have the right. So it was really nice. I miss my family, but
it's like a treat.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Even though when we first started talking about it, Eric was pretty adamant that we should try and figure out a way to, you know, for us all to quarantine and see each other and test and sort of be really safe because it would be something different. But I think it was something different anyway. It was just a little bit of a lazy day. Anyway, here we are. So we hope that you all had a great holiday. And it is December now.
It is.
We're almost there.
Yes.
We almost survived it.
I know, right?
And we are reading a rom-com. You want to talk about rom-coms? Should we start there?
Maybe we should. I think that's a good idea.
So Sally Thorne, delightful, wonderful Sally Thorne, who is an Australian romance novelist who came up through fanfic along with Christina Lauren and many of our other favorites, wrote this rom-com. And I would say this is, in fact, a rom-com. It's funny and romantic. And when she put this out, it was the first time. I mean, like, I remember seeing this cover, this cartoony cover, and thinking, oh my God, like, this is game changing. Like, something is going to happen now.
Well, and I think we've seen that, right, to be the case. So this was 2016. And I think we see the long tail of this kind of packaging and marketing and plotting the narration. I mean, I think that there's a lot of ways in which reading this for me was really interesting because I felt like I was really oh, that's where a lot of this is coming from. Now, here's the other thing I'll admit, though. I didn't read this right away. I read this probably years after it came out.
Wow, really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, no, yeah. I read it in ARC form. I read it early. I put it in the Washington Post column. And I really felt like, at the time, there was, there weren't that many books like this, which is hard to kind of, like, wrap your head around. There was Christina Lauren, who were, like, the best at it. And really, they were, like, alone at the top.
Mm-hmm.
There was lots and lots of contemporary romance, small towns, really modern romance meaning romance set in a very modern way that felt mm-hmm. very modern.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all, like, in mass market paperback, like, with the, handsome right. couple on the cover. And Christina Lauren's books were just kind of turning a corner and having these kind of differently styled covers. But like I said, this, the Hating Game cover with the two cartoon figures and the, like, hand-lettered stuff was really cool. And it's funny because now I think we're all so tired. Like, it feels like look, there are a lot of reasons why these cartoon covers exist and why they work, I think, for readers. And we should talk a little bit about that. But you can't get away from the fact, and there's sort of an irony to it because I write historicals, right? Like, you want to talk about a group of books that look the same. Like, you really can't get more samey than the historical, right? But I want to talk about covers. I think this is the right episode for us to talk about covers in. Because I feel like the thing about these covers is just like a historical with a lady in a giant dress on the cover telegraphs a thing to a reader. For me, this cover, this The Hating Game cover, when it first came out, it telegraphed the thing. And that thing was, holy shit, somebody has written Bridget Jones again. As a reader. And like, we're talking about Bridget Jones came out when I was in high school. And it was the best. Like, I remember reading, I haven't read, caveat everyone, I haven't reread Bridget Jones. I've watched the movie many, 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 many times. I have not reread the book. So I don't know if it holds up. I don't know anything about it. But I remember reading that book in high school and thinking, like, oh my God, this is the book. Like, I want to be Bridget. I want to live this, like, this life. I want to be this person. And suddenly, like, The Hating Game came, rioting into romance.
Right.
And it felt transformational.
I mean, so I just looked it up. I read this. I'm like, sorry, Sally. I bought it on Book Outlet because it was like a couple bucks and I had not read it. And I actually didn't read this book until late December of 2017. So I was a whole year plus after kind of everyone else read it. And it wasn't necessarily that I think I just started reviewing at that point, maybe. Or it had, and was kind of like, well, I guess I should read this thing that everybody's reading, right? Like, it was not, and I liked it. It was.
But everybody was talking about it.
Everybody was talking about it, yeah.
And that's I think, what we have been looking for this season is kind of like.
Right.
And all the books that we have planned for the seasons are not always books that everybody is talking about, but it's not, a lot of them will be. But everybody talked about this because it felt like something was happening, and something did happen. I mean, we cannot deny the impact of this book on the
absolutely
genre.
Absolutely.
And so I want to talk about that. And then I also want to talk about the fact that it was this book, because there is so much, it's such a deliciously tropey kind of book that kind of knows what it wants to do.
Well, and that it does it very, very well. And I think that's what I want to talk about, which is like, we in text sort of talked about like listing some of the things we want to talk about. And I think a really big one is that, like, unpacking the difference between like enemies to lovers and rivals to lovers, right? We've got single person, you know, heroine only point of view. We have first person present. There's a lot going on here that I think gets, I mean, you know, as in like romance as a genre, like we want books that sell people, right? So of course people are going to try and mimic and mine some of like what's going on here. Mm-hmm. But this book does a lot of things very, very well and walks a real tightrope in particular, I think, with Lucy as a character. That I think she makes it look very something. She makes something very difficult look very, very easy.
Oh my gosh. It's on this read. I have not read this book since I read this book for the first time.
Right.
And so on this read, and I think partially because now we do the podcast and whatever, I'm 4 years older as a writer. So now when I read things, I'm thinking about very different things, right? And there is the humor that is in this book. If you had asked me last week, like, what's the humor in The Hating Game? I would have told you it was situational. And it's not.
No, like, I don't think so at all.
No, yeah. This is the thing. It's like, in my head, this is a very funny book. And it is, like, really rom-con-y.
Commie.
It is real rom-com-y. And, like, when you think about the rom-com, you think about situational humor. You think about the way it works in movies.
Yes.
Right? That is not what this is. This book is a character. It's character humor. The humor is almost exclusively Lucy. She's a delightful character who, like, you kind of want to hang out with. And you're so instantly, and I kept thinking back on the Christina Lauren conversation that we had around fanfic and how, like, so much of fan service in fanfic is about making sure that is like giving the readers, the fans, the opportunity to really like get to soak in the experiences of these characters, right? So it at one point today, I texted you and I was like, this book is so much longer than I remember.
Yeah, right. Well, and I had texted you when I started and said, if you had asked me when they kissed in the elevator, I would have said the end of chapter one right away. That's how it starts.
Yeah.
It was 75 pages in.
Yeah. And I had completely forgotten the back end of this book, the third act, because I thought it ended after the paintball fight. The paintball fight is like halfway. Yeah.
That's like the end of act two, right?
It's so funny that you have I have these memories of this book but the reason why is because Sally packs in these amazing scenes of these two just, like, talking.
Yes.
It's such a talky book.
Yeah, that's it. Like, right where the humor in this book is based in dialogue, it's based in the way Lucy thinks about the world and herself. It's about her observational rather than situational.
Yeah.
Right? And
there's nothing situational. Not even paintball, which is what I remembered, right? Like, so I was like, oh, there's that paintball scene. So that it's situational humor, except that's not funny, that scene.
No, not at all.
It's romantic and, like, kind of weird.
Yeah.
And then it leads into a sick bed scene that has to be, like,
oh, yeah,
Kate's on everyone's favorite, list.
Sure.
Kate Claiborne has got to have that on, like, lock, that sick bed scene.
So let's do a really quick plot summary.
Oh, yeah, I forgot we did
only
that.
Only because I think it might be useful.
Because right? everyone else should remember the plot, too.
Sure. Lucy Hutton is our heroine, and she is works with her arch nemesis, right? Joshua Templeman. One of my favorite, I don't know, do you ever, you were a Buffy fan, right?
Yeah, of course.
You remember the part where there's those like three bad guys and they're talking about Buffy and they're, I think it's like, right? And he, and she's like, they're my arch, it's my arch nemesis. Anyway, they work together at essentially a publishing house that was two different houses that had been merged together. And in this merge, there are still kind of two CEOs, and they are the assistant to each one. And, you know, it has been a really rocky and rough transition. And so they, like, sit in this office and glare at each other, and it's all, you know, like, kind of stark and mirrored and cold. And Lucy is convinced that Josh is essentially her mortal enemy.
Well, yeah, I mean, page and, four. Yeah. I mean, just the introduction alone of this book is really a great, it's a great lesson in how to start a book.
Yeah.
Especially because, again, you know, the lesson that writers get taught all the time is, like, you have to start with action. Right? Like, starting with action, puts the characters on the page, like, gets the readers invested in the story. Like, you think about Susan Elizabeth Phillips starting with, you know, the beaver costume on the side of the road, or like, you know, Beverly Jenkins starting Indigo with like the knock on the floor underneath the chair from the Underground Railroad. Like, something's happening. Sally starts this book and it's so internal. It's like, you are steeped in Lucy. And on page four, she says, the second, the most essential thing anyone needs to know about me is this. I hate Joshua Templeman. Like, it's on the page. And instantly you're like, catnip. Like, trope, 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 trope. Like, neon sign.
Yes.
It's going to be enemies to lovers. Strap in.
I think one of the things that this book really does well, there are many, is it really doesn't flinch away at all from, like, enemies to lovers means these people are really fucking mean to each other.
Down.
Right? And I think that there's a way in which enemies to lovers often in other books kind of largely happens off page. Like, we've been enemies, but boom, now we're not. And this book really commits to her dislike of him, or her she's convinced she dislikes him, right? But that how many times she defaults into that behavior, even when she knows it's not quite right anymore. You know, everyone knows I hate present tense passionately. I think it's the right choice here.
She wields it like a knife.
Yeah. Lucy doesn't understand something about herself.
Yep.
And as we read this book, we're understanding it with her. And she is surprised by things that are happening. And that's, like, the scene in the elevator literally, I think, needed to be in present tense. Her shock at, like, what is happening is, and so as much as I hate it as a general rule and still struggled sometimes with it, I'm not going to lie to you, it's the right choice for this story.
Absolutely. Also, there are scenes in this book that would not work in past tense, period. Like the sick scene. The sick scene has to be in present tense because she reveals so much about herself that she would never tell you in past tense.
Right.
Or remember, honestly. Right?
Yeah. Right.
So there's that. And then I think there's this really interesting piece of the puzzle that is like, yeah, there are several moments where I thought to myself, oh, this would only work in third person or in present.
Right.
But how many times have you and I talked about, like, it takes a remarkable writer to pull off some of this stuff, right?
Yes, right.
Like, first person present works in Sally Thorne. It works in Christina Lauren. Like, you have to be a star to pull it off.
I think I don't know that I think I'm like, God, I fucking hate present tense so goddamn much, everybody. Here's what I'll say. I think it really suits a certain kind of story really well.
Well, this is Lucy's story.
Right. And it's, and her not like hiding this from herself.
Yeah.
My problem is when people try and use present tense when the character knows something and just isn't telling the reader. Yes, I'm like, that exactly. doesn't make any goddamn sense. What the fuck are you doing?
Exactly.
Right?
But here's the thing. She doesn't make any mistakes because in the hands of a lesser author, Josh would have been on the page, also in first person present. And the whole book hinges, the sort of conflict of the book hinges on what Josh knows, right?
Yes.
And so then you would have had a sort of messy situation, right? But she knew, she sort of instinctively knew, I can't put Josh on the page. But also this is why this book felt like revolutionary in many ways, and like the return of chick lit in so many ways, because suddenly we were looking at a romance novel where the heroine's at the center of the story. It is her story entirely, except Sally's. She's created this character in Josh who, like, we understand instinctively as romance readers, right? Yeah. Like, there's no at the second she finds his planner and sees the hash marks, we're like, oh, he's deep into you.
Yeah, well, right? And that's the thing that I think is, you know, and we've talked about this too. When you have a single character point of view, the hardest thing to do is communicate that the other character has fallen in love with you or is in love with you just through that character's observations. And this is, I think, the real genius of this book, is there are times when Josh acts in a way that we as readers understand means one thing, and Lucy does not understand what it means. And I think that this is part of, you know, again, like the tightrope of, I feel like if I was writing in present tense, I would be studying this book because it does a really masterful job of showing us that the other person is fallen in love without us knowing what's in their brain. And that, I think my big problem with present tense is a lot of the time that doesn't work. Or, like I said, it's a mismatch for the kind of story you're going to tell. I mean, you know, there's a lot of... Yeah. But I also would like to say, along with this, my other kind of present tense issue is, if every book that's written in present tense by an author sounds exactly the same, well, that doesn't make sense to me either, because of the way the voice in this book, and we don't talk about voice a whole lot.
Lucy is so clear.
Yes.
And that's unique. The other she's thing. Not.
Yes.
She's not like other girls. Yeah, but I mean that in like a romance-y way. Like.
She really
can see this first person present character.
Yes. And I think that's the other thing is, as a default, people are just like, I'm just writing in present tense. And I'm like, okay, great. I get that it's really popular now and people like it and, you know, whatever. But like, if every single character you write sounds the same, this is why I struggle. I'm like, okay, I read that book. You're the blurbs in present tense. I have zero memory of what happened. I don't even know these people's fucking names. Like, because they're just, there's no voice there.
But, like, sometimes in those books, you don't even see – you don't know what they look like. You don't know what their names are. Like, we know Lucy's name from the start. We know what Lucy looks like. Like, because she's doing it so well.
But she also – and I was really fascinated by this – introduces herself to us.
I want to talk about this so badly. The start of this book is, like, kind of breaking the fourth wall.
And this is a thing, Kate, you know, people joke, like Kate and I joke all the time, like we fight about it sometimes on Twitter, but we talk about it all the time on texts. But, you know, this is like a really interesting thing because my biggest problem with present tense is I don't narrate my life to myself as I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So I just, as a way of understanding the world, it doesn't make sense to me. And I also highly resent being forced to make meaning about things as they're happening. So, like, these two things are really, like, it's big two strikes. I'm like, I don't walk around telling myself what I'm doing while I'm doing it. And I don't make meaning the minute things happen. This is fucking weird.
Mm-hmm. But she's not doing that.
It's clear from this narrative at the beginning that this is, like, a story she's telling.
Yeah, she's like, hey, Jen, let me tell you this story.
Yeah. And I don't know how I feel about it, but fine.
Oh, you don't know how you feel about it. Oh, I kind of love it. I love it because I think it immediately cleans the slate of all the problems that you have with first, that, I mean, you can have with first, you in the vague sense, can have with first person present. Because she's saying, like, you're in on my joke. Like, I know where we are, Laura.
Okay, this is my brain, and I apologize, everybody.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to try. This is real fucked up, everybody. I'm sorry. Okay, so a romance has the HEA, right? We as readers know it's going to turn out okay. So the thing about present tense is the characters don't know. They genuinely have no idea what's going to happen, right? Like, that's the deal with present tense. Like, there's no future for them. They don't know how
so
it's going
to saying because it's present tense, she can't let us in on the secret.
Yes. Like, that just doesn't – it's like time travel is for some people. They're like, if I think about it too much, nothing makes sense. I'm like, wait. So at the beginning, she knows she's telling the story that actually has already happened. And yet the whole time we're reading it, she doesn't know what the fuck is going on. Right? And again, I get that other people don't have the time – I'm going to call it the time travel problem because I think it's like the closest analogy. And some people are like, fuck it. Time travel is amazing. I don't care. Yeah.
I might have that problem with a different book, but I do not have it with this one.
Like, fair.
And right. That is one of those, and that is why I say all the time, like, I'm really interested when writers are trying something really different. And I think that, look, Sally Thorne did not invent first-person present.
Of
she did not.
Not
invent, like, I'm not, I, she's not like, you know, rom-com Jesus, but she is doing a thing with this book that at the time felt really revolutionary for all the reasons. Look, here's the truth. It felt revolutionary also because it had a giant publisher behind it who said, we're going to put a stake in the ground and bring back chick lit.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember if that's what we called it in 2016, but like, that's what this is. Like,
right.
In, you know, 1997, when they were published, when Bridget Jones came out, that was called chick lit, and we all read it. I mean, like, it was the thing everyone was reading. And then after Bridget Jones, there were all the copycats. Like, The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing was one of my favorite ones. And, like, Jennifer Weiner wrote all of, like, Good in Bed and all of those. And, like, everyone had these kind of great, solid, like, single woman against the world books. And then the market just dropped right out from under them. Harlequin started a line. So when I graduated college, I moved to New York and I worked in publishing. I started working for a small boutique PR firm that handled kind of curious author, sometimes hard to handle authors. So like, publishing houses would hire us to like handhold authors who needed a lot of handholding.
Interesting.
But then also at the same time, like sometimes authors who like wanted a little more attention would come and hire us themselves. And it was 2000 and I started working with Harlequin for a line of books called Red Dress Ink. Do you remember those books?
No.
They were basically like Harlequin saw that there was a big market for chick lit. I mean, like for Bridget Jones read-alikes, like if you loved Bridget, then you will love all these other women. And, the line was called Red Dress Ink. And I worked on a handful of the Red Dress Ink books because my boss by that point had figured out that I was a romance reader and like threw me a bone and let me work on them. And it lasted, I mean, we'll look it up and put it in show notes, but like it lasted no length of time. It lasted a year, maybe like maybe even less. And then the bottom dropped out of the market. So it probably lasted about 4 or 5 years that like chick-lit market. All the books looked the same. All the books sounded the same.
Sure.
And like those of us, this is one of those situations, right? Like romance ebbs and flows. So, for example, in the early aughts, in like 2001 or 2005, like paranormal was just at its height, and then like the bottom dropped out of paranormal, and like suddenly houses weren't acquiring paranormals, and paranormal readers were really stuck. Right?
Yeah.
Because it was like, well, you still get your Cressley or your Nalini or your, you know, Jeanine Frost. But like, if you're looking for a new author to throw onto your list, like that's a harder find.
Right.
So, and that's just the way the market, you know, it cycles. And so sometimes historical is up and, you know, sometimes contemporary is up. And so I think that what happened was chick lit just like traditional publishing houses got bored. I mean, I think we're going to start seeing less and less of this kind of big swing, pendulum swing market forces because now, you know, indie publishing exists. And so.
Right. Sure. There's always.
There's no. Yeah. If an editor gets bored of the books in traditional, somebody in indie is still publishing them.
Yeah. Right.
But that's real, right? Like, we see that happen in YA. And everybody says, like, well, whatever happened to vampires? Like, what happened to vampires was people got bored in the offices in New York. And then, and sometimes maybe readers too, right? But it's a little of both. So this book comes in, has this like cover that feels different than any other contemporary cover we'd seen in a long time. And definitely different from Bridget Jones too. So like something really fresh and different. Had the marketing machine of William Mora behind it. I mean, I assume, because it was everywhere. And it also, added bonus, it was really well written. And so here we are. And it's, I think what is interesting about it is it's sort of the confluence of so many events. It's like, well, contemporary, small, like contemporary had to get a, got a facelift essentially with these covers and like this first person present. And then there was kind of the influx of fanfic and this idea that like fanfic had power, which we were, which other houses were seeing too, because, you know, Christina Lauren had gotten their big, like, beautiful series published, you know, right out of Twilight fanfic, right? So like, publishers were starting to pay attention to these kind of outside forces. And I think everyone was really looking for, like, the book that would, like, land perfect. And Lucy's really charming. I think it spoke to a lot that was going on for all of us. Like, this was right before, interestingly, Sally, an Australian, spoke to America. And this book, we have no idea where this book is set.
That's really interesting
it's
to
cool,
me, too.
It's cool, right? Yes. So I saw someone somewhere was like, oh, it's set in New York. And I'm like, it's not. It's definitely not set in New York. There's no identifying
location.
It's like
generic city. Yes.
And right. I think there's something kind of interesting about that, something that makes it work about, like, kind of, again, I've kept thinking about what Christina and Lauren talked about, where you can sort of, like, see yourself in the story. Like, you can really put yourself down on the page. This is you and your job. And I remember the first time I ever read it, I was like, where is this book taken? Like, where does this take place? You can tell in the writing that she's not American.
Yeah, there's a couple times it's, but it's generically enough that I feel like it could pass for American. I mean, right?
Yeah. And so, so there's this real sense. So anyway, so Lucy and Josh are enemies and they play, but I want to talk about the games.
Yeah.
Because the other thing, there's something remarkable. And Jen, I don't know if you and I have talked about this recently, but I've been thinking a lot about this over the last couple of months. This kind of question that we're all asking in 2020 about contemporaries, like how do contemporaries land? You know, we're hearing anecdotally from readers that like they're more interested maybe in reading historicals or like paranormals and like because coronavirus is real and like we're in a pandemic and it's weird to think like, oh, they should be wearing masks, right?
Well, I put this on Twitter. There's a part in here where she's like, we're exchanging each other's breath. Mm-hmm. And I was like, huh.
Yeah.
Please don't be safe,
too much.
Right?
Too much. Be safe. Make good choices. So, but at the same time, I think that the contemporaries that are working for me still are the ones that still have that real, like, fantasy element, that romance
fantasy. And this
fantasy.
One, right. Yeah.
And these games, this one does. It feels like you're in a fantasy world, like you're in a hermetically sealed, like there's no pandemic in this bubble at all.
There's no other world, really.
Yeah. No. But what I love about it is that in part it's because Lucy, so we're always in Lucy's point of view and she talks about it. She said, and she describes all the games that she and Josh play, right? So there's the staring game where they sometimes like stare at each other to see like who will blink first. Or like they're playing, when we first meet her, they're playing the mirror game where like everything she does, he does like just an instant later. And because they share an office, they are both assistants to co-CEOs of a publishing company that has merged. And then there's like the how you doing game and the, you know, they have all these different games.
So the thing that was really fascinating for me about this, though, too, is I was like, well, these are Lucy's games, though.
And I mean, does he play them, right? Is he really playing them?
Is he really playing them? Now, clearly some of them, right? The mirror game, clearly, yes. But
this is the magic of it.
Yes. And when she discovers his planner, she's like, he's playing a game I don't know about.
I need to understand his game.
Yes.
And then what's that called? The Stalking Josh game or the like?
Yes. Yeah. The Stalking game, right?
And so, no. And I, what I love about it is that, and then, well, it becomes, so at first you're like, it's her, these are her games and is he playing them? Right. And then as they get closer and closer and like the burn, you know, it's a very slow one, but like as the burn continues and they get closer and closer together, there are moments where like at one point they just acknowledge that like whenever one of them says the word HR,
that's the end
of the game, right? That's their safe word.
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, it really was.
And what I love about this is that this is not a thing that would happen in real life.
Right. Absolutely not.
And it is so romance reasony. Like, it just is. These two people are, they hate each other and they play these games.
Yep.
And they both know that they know the way the game, they know the rules of the games and they know when they're playing them and when they're not playing them for romance reasons.
Yep. Absolutely.
And as a reader, you're like, I am in.
So the other thing I think that's like really masterful about this is the dialogue, right? In that if you have, okay, like I teach this thing to my kids about characterization, right? Like, so we don't have Josh's point of view. We don't have access to his thoughts and feelings. We only have access to his words, right? And we only have access to his behavior. And even then, I don't think she's actually a very good, the thing that's really fascinating about Lucy is she's clearly not a very, she doesn't really pay attention to his behavior in the way we do. Right. So she reports things he does and we know what they mean. And she, but then that
she
means
can't
that
put it together.
Right. But we can. But then that means that dialogue is so important because it is our only way to access him as a person.
Yes.
And their interactions are like, I mean,
they're sparkling
and they're sharp. And there's ways in which they communicate to each other and talk to each other that, like, and I think that's the part that, again, really works here is you're cutting us off from Josh in every single way. But here is this one way, and it is so fantastic. And I think that's the other thing that really works here is I think that Sally really understands, like, ultimately how much of Josh we need in order to keep buying this, because the fact of the matter is their interactions are so tense and sometimes so terse that it's, there has to be a payoff. Like there has to be an emotional payoff.
Yes.
And I think that that's one of the things that becomes really clear is, and I suggested at the beginning, we've already talked kind of a little bit about acts, that this book seems long because there's three really well-defined acts.
Distinct, yes.
You know? So to me, they are the up to, like, the kiss in the elevator.
Yep.
Right? And then I'd say, like, act two is everything between that and then and when the they wedding. Go to the wedding. And then the wedding is act three.
And do you notice that during the acts, she opens the world in each act too?
Yes.
Which is so fast. Like, I was like, gosh, this is so perfectly crafted. Like, the first 100 pages are just the two of them.
Just the two of them.
And then.
And no, just in the office.
And, like, and the way that the, I kept thinking about that Slate article that you tweeted. The way that she articulates the design of their office where everything is mirrored. So it's the two of them and they can see their reflections everywhere around them.
And her lipstick is flamethrower. Like it's like all sprayed.
It's perfect. And it's everything's perfect. Like white and chrome and black, except for her shoes and her lipstick. And then there are these two doors that seem to be always closed, and that's where their bosses live or work. And then the elevator.
It's like Thunderdome or a fishbowl or something,
it's
right?
It's wild. So that's it. It's deeply claustrophobic in the first act. And then it opens up and we start to see them with workplace people.
Literally an elevator to the new act, right?
Yes. Yes.
Like, let me transport you and a car ride to the third, right? Yeah.
And then the third is his family.
Right.
Which is a really, I mean, like, that's a scene you have to love. I know you, that scene is your catnip when she yells at the dad.
I feel like, yeah, especially reading it Thanksgiving week, because it reminded me so perfectly of her Thanksgiving treat. Is that the name of it? Where the...
Her naughty, isn't it her naughty holiday?
Her naughty holiday. It's his
Tiffany Rice.
Yeah, right. Where there's a similar, like, sort of blow up at the Thanksgiving dinner. Yeah, it's amazing. So, I mean, that's the thing. Like, this book is so clear. I mean, it's so
good at
what it's doing.
I'm going to mark the end of the third act where you did, but slightly later. So they're kissing in the elevator on the way down, and she's going to a date that she told him she was going on and then had to, like, collect a date to do, which is adorable, with a very sweet man who's very sweet and wrong for her. And she gets to the bar, and he's like, you know, Josh drives her to the bar and whatever. He doesn't think she's actually going on a date. It's like a game of chicken. And then she's like, no, I'm literally, like, I'm meeting this guy. And he's like, what? And so they get to the bar, and she's left her coat in his car. So, like, she goes in, she meets this her date. They're, like, about to start. And her date says, you look beautiful. And she's kind of wrecked by that. Like, he's just, you know, Josh has just kissed her, but he's never complimented her. They're always at each other's throats. Like, what is happening there? And then, like, here's this nice boy who's like, you look beautiful. That was my dog dropping a bone at my feet. And so then she's like, she kind of has to collect herself. So she goes to the bathroom, and she's waiting in the hallway outside the bathrooms. And Josh comes in with her coat and finds her. And she's like emotional. And she's like, you broke me. Like, and he says, she says, like, congratulations, you had a good day, like, you made me cry. And he says, is that the prize you think I'm playing for? And, like, I had chills, because it's the first time Josh acknowledges that they're playing games.
Yes, right.
And then it's like the door closes and we're in act two. I mean, there are some great moments in this book.
I'm interested in the way in which this is a book that's really about how hard it is to, like, change your own behavior even after you've changed your own mind. And I know I've, like, alluded to this before, but there's a lot of times, and I guess it's especially in that second act and for sure in the third act with Josh and the way he acts around his family, that we see that people are kind of like, I don't want to treat people this way anymore, but I am now in the habit of doing it and I don't know how to get out of it. And there's so many times, and I felt that something that this book does really well is it's so human, right? And there's something that's fantasy-like about the setting and the way it is set up, but way more realistic about the way in which people sometimes shoot themselves in the fucking foot.
Yes. Yes.
Like, we see that they're perfect for each other at some point, and yet they keep screwing it up. And one of the things that's really interesting about that is that Josh deeply understands that that is, like, Lucy's MO. And the whole second act where he's like, no, I'm not going to let you rush me into this and then freak out and take off. Like, I, you know, and I think the first time around, I was like, meh, it's kind of controlling. But the second time around, it's really deeply where you're like, no, he just really knows her better than she knows herself. And that is a really fascinating, again, like narratively speaking, it's a fascinating setup. The non-point of view character understands the point of view character better than she understands herself, and it's communicated to us as readers.
Yes. Yes.
What magic is that?
And then on top of it, the layering of that, right, with the story about Josh's Easter egg, like, about how, like, in his lifetime, all of the other people in his life, like aimed for something, and when they got it, they just, like, wrecked it. And Josh, like, savored the thing. Like, once he got it, he savored it. And it was his alone. And, I mean, he's a very good hero.
Yeah, like, he is.
And I want to talk about him as a hero because knowing, of course, that Sally came up through Twilight fanfic, knowing who else, what other heroes came through Twilight fanfic, right? It's hard not to compare this hero who is Chrome and Steel, like with his perfectly clean house, to another hero who is Chrome and Steel right. and with a perfectly clean house, right? And I think that what's really fascinating is that what Sally has done is softened the alpha here, right? Where there is no question that Josh is really, like, distinctly impenetrable at the beginning of this book. Like, he is he's an old school hero. It feels like those old school books where, like, the heroine's just kind of, like, being heroiny all over the place. And the hero is, you can't see him. He's a cipher, right? And then a literal, he's literally got a code book, yes, right?
Right, exactly.
And so, and then as she softens him, you start to really unpack all of the pain, the like harmful layers in there. Like he comes to understand his own difficulties as, you know, as somebody who has been built by obvious patriarchy, right? Like, his dad is terrible.
I will say, I did find his dad was almost like a misstep to me. I didn't quite believe
you found
it.
Him
I was
like too much.
The whole part about where he was like, he wouldn't pay my tuition. I was like, bullshit, come on. Like, you know, my mom had to pay it. That kind of felt like almost too over the top to me. I was like, there is no way. Because a man like that, I could see him shaming Josh for not going to medical school. Like, that kind of yeah. stuff was believable to me. But I
that
guess
line
way,
about, like, I've seen his email, like, signature line, assistant to the CEO. Like, that
yes,
felt real. Like,
that woof. Was all, that all felt super real.
Yeah.
But some of it, and part of it was because a person like that is so tied up into how other people think that there's no way he would have refused to pay Josh's tuition because of how bad it would have made him look.
Yeah.
You know, well, like, two doctors don't play those games. Like, that was, like, the one thing in the book where I literally, it felt like a kind of, like, clang. I was like, what was that? That didn't really make sense to me.
Yeah.
His disdain of Josh, of wanting, you know, sometimes I don't know. It went really hard in a way I think was too hard, but whatever.
I think it's interesting because I did not have the same clang, but yeah. I did have a moment where I was like, does this ship turn around as fast as it seems like he does with Lucy? Yeah. But I sort of loved the idea that, like, maybe because nobody's ever talked to him this way.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Which is why this scene is always, I mean, this is your trope. This is your yes. id here. Like,
absolutely.
You love right? it when a person goes to a family event and then absolutely shreds everyone on behalf of their love.
Yes, absolutely. I did. And I think that the reason this is also so important is because I think one of the things that's really interesting about this book is, like, all this, like, what I'll call parody. And at the beginning, at work, Josh is really seen as being, like, a bad guy, right? People are scared of him and, you know, people are afraid to give him their reports if they're late. And he was the one who was responsible for cutting the jobs of 125 people, including our best friend. And so at the end, for him to then be unable to, like, do that to his own father and have her be the one who stands up for him, I felt like that was a really important, like, countermeasure, right? Mm-hmm. Because we had to see him in a vulnerable way. And he was kind of master of the universe with her all along, right? The game he was playing was mm-hmm. bigger than the game she was playing, and we get that, and so does she at some point. But he was never able to, like, play a game with his dad. So I do think it was really important, and also I fucking loved it. And I love that Lucy had that moment of, like, you know, I mean, an audience of people cheering her on the way out from
yeah.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's great.
It was awesome. It was yeah. awesome, and it worked great, and I love that the mom was like, oh my God, I love her. Like, yeah. I loved a lot of it.
Yeah.
The ending was really interesting because I had completely, I mean, full disclosure, everyone, I had completely forgotten about this ending. I
That's
really
so
believed
interesting to me.
The ending was the paintball.
That's so
and
fascinating
then, like,
to me.
In my head, if you had said to me, what was this book? I would have said, oh, it's situational comedy, because this is the book we call, like, This right. brought back the rom-com.
Right.
Right? And this is maybe where we need to talk about the rom-com. And I would have said it ended with paintball and the sick bed. Like, the sick bed yeah. moment was, like, where they realized that they were into each other. But none of that is true. That is the middle, the flat middle of this book. Like,
I remembered the wedding. What I had, and I, as soon as I came back to the wedding, I remembered that he had not told her the truth about the bride.
Yeah, Mandy.
I was like, oh, Mindy. Right, oh, shit, Mindy, right? Here's what I had forgotten. I had sort of, I knew that he had, like, another job lined up and hadn't told her about it.
Mm.
And in my brain, I was like, "There, I really hate the way it ends with him, like, lording it over her that he has, like, solved this whole problem." And that's not how it plays out at all either.
No.
Right? I had sort of, where he like, admits it to her, like, in bed, and it's fine. And he's just like, look, I resigned already. And in my brain, it had been more of a like, ha ha. And
yeah,
really
yeah.
It wasn't. So that was really interesting. The tricks, because it's so interior.
So internal. I mean,
right?
It's so, as a writer, like, it's amazing when you read something that you just know you could not ever write. And I could not write this book. It's so internal.
Well, it is a real masterclass in character growth and development.
It's terrific.
In voice. But I think that that's it. It's like, you know, the thing about the reason we remember these big external events is because so much of it is
exactly.
the
it's like
internal stuff.
Having coffee and like yes. leaving each other strawberries and donuts.
I mean, if you wrote this out, like if someone had a plot wall, right? I mean...
No.
I mean, and that's the thing. And, you know, I like plot. Don't get
no,
me wrong.
But it's such a delicious. And, like, you don't get bored. You're not bored.
No, not
like,
at all.
You're just like, I want to see these two people together, which is sort of fascinating and also, like, proof that Sally doesn't misstep here because she gives you exactly what you want, which is these right. two dummies together as much as possible.
Like, yes. Well, that's the other thing, I think.
There are
right?
so few moments where they're talking to someone else. And when they're talking, yeah. this does not pass the romance Bechdel test either. Like,
no.
there's not even a second in this book is donated to anything that is not related to the other character.
Absolutely. Oh, and that's, I think, again.
That's why it's so fun to read.
Yes.
Because it's all right? fantasy. Like,
yes.
I really believe that that's where contemporaries are shining. Like, this book yeah. felt even, I might have enjoyed it even more reading it in 2020 after, like, during a pandemic.
I definitely enjoyed it more.
Because, like,
yeah.
it felt like, oh, this is a gift. It's like yeah. a gift to be reading something that is totally out of time.
Yes. Yeah. I think the other thing for me is... I think that there's a really interesting thing that happens in romance with, like, the low moment and, like, a redemption arc. And, right, and I think that sometimes it feels, for many readers, like, a little, it's, like, fake. Oh, well, I got to 85%, and so now something bad is going to happen. And, right, and I think that another reason that this book really succeeds is that it understands that, like, typical romance plotting or that arc wouldn't really play out successfully. And I think it's because so much of the rest of the book is so internal that to sort of have that, like, now I'm going to stomp off and, you know, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. Like, there's a crisis at the end of this book. But I mean, I would say for me, it was really interesting. Like, the big crisis for me was when she finds out he hasn't told her the truth about the bride.
Yeah, well, because she like, feels like she's being yes. used for something.
Yeah, and when she says that, imagine the tables were turned. And if I, right, and if I had dragged you all around a family wedding and shown you off and, like, hung all over you, and then you found out later that, I, you know, the groom was my ex and I hadn't told you. Right? Like, her ability to, like, put that in perspective for him. And then they do have this, like, big fight, but they, like, work it out.
Yeah. And it's very real.
Yes. And it's not like, I mean, there's a moment where she's like, I'm going to get on a bus and go, where it could have turned into that. And it's Josh who's like, like, no, we're not going to do that, right? We're going to, like, talk this out. And my mom talked to you, and I'm going to talk to you, and we're going to do this thing. And I think that that's something that in a book that's so in, and again, we've talked about this, I know, but, like, a book that is so heavily determined, that's so internal, I think has to then be worked out internally. Like, does that make sense? And so the fight for that fight that they have afterwards, and then they have sex, right? Mm-hmm.
Finally.
Finally, right? I know. I was really like, oh, God, this takes forever. I forgot about this. Lots of making out, though.
So a lot of dry humping.
And I'm fine with that. That's, like, really all I need. I felt the same way with BetMe. I was like, it's like when nothing happens and all of a sudden they go from kissing to fucking at 70% that I'm like, what happened? But I think this part about, you know, it's really a moment where we see I have made so many mistakes. I've made so many assumptions about him. I've jumped to conclusions. And then here is the opportunity for that to happen again. And we turned back from it. That's, like, really satisfying.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then they have to go back to the real world of their jobs. But that's all. At that point.
No, that's.
Right? It's nothing.
Now, well, and what's interesting is Sally ends the book when their jobs become fossils.
Mm-hmm.
Like, their jobs are just, like, their job is themselves for the whole book.
Yes.
And then now they're going to go off and they're going to be people who, like, have jobs and then are in love after work. And and Sally's like, you don't want that.
No, wait, you don't need any of those details. I mean,
which is why, so there's something to be said here for, we haven't talked about, like, this whole book is cat versus cat too. Like, it's so rivals to lovers. And because of that, you end up feeling really like, and she does it so clearly too in the dialogue. It's like, no one gets one over on the other unless, you know, without there being an immediate response. Like, there's the parry is very clear.
Uh-huh.
And it's clever and funny. And, you know, she really doesn't use the safe. They don't safe word as much as you might think that they would. Like, they, you know, at first HR is, like, part of the joke. And then, you know, it's so well done. These two figures who are equally important to the company, to the relationship, to, you know, the world. They have this really wonderful, they are exact equals. And I have to say, like, I read The Hating Game when I was plotting Bare Knuckle Bastards. And, like, there was a reason why Hattie and Whit were rivals to lovers. And it was because this book made it so clear to me that, like, cat versus cat is the most interesting way to tell this story. Yeah. And it's, you know, one of my favorite tropes for the reason that I think Sally did so much work teaching me how to write this.
I think the brilliance of it is that I think a real dark path that people can turn down, a mistake that can get made, is if you root rivals to lovers and one person doesn't respect the other person's work or admire their talents, right? Then you're like, well, now that person's just a jerk.
Right.
And the thing that's fascinating is it is clear from the beginning that their dislike of each other is about, like, demeanor, comportment, like, their way of doing the work, but not their ability to do the work itself.
No.
And I think that that's really important because,
well, she establishes that so well when she, right at the start, in that sort of first kind of breaking the fourth wall, like, kind of moment, she explains how this company came to be.
Yes.
And she's like, you know, there were, I forget what the name of the
Bexley's
company is.
And there were Bexley's or whatever,
and whatever's. And, you know, and you could tell them apart. It was, it felt like you were reading a children's book. Like you could tell the Bexleys because they wore this kind of clothing and they did this kind of thing and they cared about books as units. And you could tell the others because they were artsy, fartsy and like wore flowing clothes and always had disheveled hair and they all wore glasses and they cared about art. Like, and so you have this kind of instant, she sets it down. She lays it down again and again and again as a kind of, these two are diametrically opposed. They cannot work together. They cannot be together. They are enemies. Like, and
well, and
so as a reader, you're like, okay, yeah, I see. Like, of course they are. They're the opposite of each other.
Right. Right. And he is like cold in his way of dealing with people, too methodical, too driven by numbers. She's too much of a pushover. Right. But it's never
he's
that
tall.
Like,
she's short. Yes. Like they're so I mean, every bit of it is their opposites.
Right. But it's never that she thinks he is incompetent. And it's never that he thinks that either. And I feel like that is really one of the things I think is really important is I have seen enemies to lovers where often the man, because I guess maybe it's just really gendered or comes across as really gendered in that way. If he doesn't respect her work, forget it. Game over.
Well, also in Rivals to Lovers, one of the biggest challenges is what happens at the end.
Yes.
Because they can't both get the job. They can't, like, if one of them is going to leave the job, it has to be for a good reason. Like, you can't just be like, well, I want you to have it. I'm seeding the ground.
Right. Right.
She handles it really well.
And that part, because she's sick, and again, this was on the reread, I noticed it, right, where he whispers to her, like, if there was a way I could solve it where it didn't have to be like this. And she's like, you know, completely drugged down. She's like, yes, fix it. Right.
Yeah.
And so then we get like, oh, OK. It kind of softens everything that comes after.
Sure.
I feel like the one other we talked about Josh's parents. We didn't talk about her parents.
Yeah.
I was really fascinated this time around by her fear or belief that her mother had like lost something. By choosing the farm over choosing her journalism career.
Yeah, I mean, I think her parents are really interesting because I think maybe for me, that was maybe the one moment where I was like, well, we never really, you know, she has a FaceTime call with them. And that's really like the most we get of them. I could have done without them. But it was fine. Like, I was happy that somebody loved this poor woman.
Yeah, true,
who, like,
right.
Has no one. There. That is a really interesting piece. That also sort of evoked that kind of old school feel of, like, she really had no one.
Right.
Which sucks. Right. Except for her boss. I hope in the movie they...
Pauline, yeah.
They make that boss a little more present.
I wonder if Sally Thorne, with a couple books under her belt, would have, like, cut some of that stuff out now.
The parent stuff. Yeah, maybe. She didn't need it. I mean, like, it was so perfectly crafted without it that it's almost like she put it in because she wanted her Lucy to have people who loved her. I wanted that, too.
I did, too. Yeah.
I mean, and also, well, the first look at Josh, going back to what you said about, you know, she narrates what Josh is doing and we understand what Josh is doing, but she doesn't. When he finds the blog at her family's strawberry farm.
And like knows it backwards.
And he knows that he knows the names of her parents. He's read every blog post. Like, he's seen all the pictures of her when she was a child.
Yeah.
And she thinks that he's doing it to, like, fuck with her.
Right.
And to be an asshole. And it's so clear that he's done it because he's obsessed with her. And so it's really nice.
It is.
It's nice. I like him as a hero. He's a great hero.
I do, too.
I mean, and, you know, we talk so much about the books that, why the books that work, work. And I think in romance, often it boils down to, for a lot of readers, it's like a primal response to the hero. And this love story, like, it really works because they are such a good match. And he's so into her.
Well, and I think there's a way in which once he takes care of her literally when she is sick overnight, we then understand all the ways in which he's taking care of her.
Yeah, but like even before that, the roses, when the roses turn up and she thinks it's the other guy. And you're like, Lucy, you dummy.
I know.
It's obviously not Danny who sent those.
I know.
Do you want to talk about covers? You want to talk about rom-coms? You want to talk about the long tail of the Hating Game? What do you want to do?
Here's what I guess I would say. I feel like when we talk about the long tail of the Hating Game, I feel like what we see is heroine-only point of view. I mean, especially in this trade romance.
Right. These romances often, and I mean now, format has really evolved over the last 4 years, which nobody listening is going to be surprised to hear. I mean, in 2016, mass market paperback was still, that was still format at most houses, most romance houses. Now, most of the romance houses have given up mass market as a size of a book, and most of the books are now being printed in trade. And many of them are being printed in trade with these covers. And I think that part of the reason why that is, I mean, I heard Cindy Huang, who is the editorial director, the head of the imprint at Berkeley Books, on a panel say that in part that was because they understood that YA readers were more likely to purchase books that looked like this than purchase a book that had like a couple kissing on the cover. And they she was very clear that they were making a direct, they were directly heading for the YA readership to like come over to older fiction, which I think is real. I think also you can't have this conversation without talking about the fact that there is a massive dearth of diverse, inclusive cover photos, stock photos specifically, in romance. So this makes it easier to represent diversity. I think the challenge with that, though, is that these books do not always, they are not always like as advertised. This has nothing to do with authors.
No, of course not.
And I think this is the real challenge here is like, you know, for most of us, we don't get cover consultation. We don't get to say like, oh, I want my book to be out in trade or I want my book to be out in mass market. We don't get to decide. And in many, many cases, we don't even get to choose our publisher, right? It's like you dance with the one who brung you.
Yeah, right.
Right? So then what ends up happening is this all happens and readers get angry. And look, authors get angry too. Like,
oh, I would imagine. Yeah,
and
of course.
And I think, honestly, editors, like, I think everybody would like to be able to get books in the hands of readers. And that's the challenge, right? And it's just so hard. It's such a hard, you know, there's so many layers of this that include things like stores not being willing to stock mass market because the margins aren't good. Or, there's
Walmart or Target saying, right?
I mean, let's talk about like years and years and years of stores not being willing to stock diverse romances or queer romances, like because of
right.
some buyer somewhere said they didn't want them. And so I think that what's happening is, like I said, it's growing pains. Also, you know, that the industry is really shifting now with, you know, everything's in competition. And so I think this is a thing that any author you talk to is thinking about all the time. Price point, trim size, cover, like what the cover looks like. Should we try illustrated? I mean, the number of texts that you have, that I have with other writers, like having these conversations. And I think what I can say is that I can't see how the next couple of years don't like really shake everything up.
Yeah, I agree. Especially now with this Simon & Schuster, right? And
yeah, Random House. For those of you listening who don't follow, you know, publishing news every second of the day, why not? And also, you know, Penguin Random House just bought Simon & Schuster. You know, so that's it. It's one more door closing for a lot of us.
That funnel just gets narrower. And I think that's the thing that's really hard for, I would say, and I'm not even talking as a critic. Now I'm just talking as a reader, is genre, genre fiction is a promise. And if a book or an author isn't fulfilling that promise, but the publisher is selling it as if it is.
And that's bad for the author, too. Because readers are so smart. And this is the thing, is like consumers are incredibly smart. And for a long time, romance and mystery and sci-fi, I mean, all of them, right? And I think this is happening across all the genres, this kind of like real weird shift of like what publishers are doing with the books. But over the years, I mean, over the last 50 years, like romance readers have learned to buy books like they're a product, like they're soup or cereal, like they know what the label looks like and what they want. So I think, yeah, I think the reality is that readers have learned real fast.
Right. And you know what the thing too is we've talked about is romance readers generally read really fast, right? And if you're reading 200 books a year, how many of those can be $16 books?
Yeah. But it's interesting because you can also like to sort of like pivot away from this conversation, which is a much bigger conversation about like a lot of things that like we don't know the inner workings of, right? It's funny because you look at indie romance and like the covers on indie romance and how indie moves so quickly that they're going through multiple rounds of new cover concepts, you know, in the course of a year. You know, you see end titles like Step Brothers are big, so now everybody's writing a Step Brother book. Or, right. Bullies are big, so everybody's doing that. Or, shirtless men are big. Well, shirtless men are always going to be big. Sure. Or,
hockey players or right, whatever, right.
And so you're seeing the whole you're seeing in indie this just kind of constant chasing of the market. So it's really fascinating because romance seems like indie seems like it's behaving the way romance always did behave. In traditional, where it was like, everybody's right. Oh, you're writing a vampire? Then we're all going to start writing vampires. And then, so it's just fast. It's a really, I think it's a fascinating genre, obviously, or we wouldn't have a podcast. And we've now gotten really far away from the Hating Game. But she did, I mean, like, it changed the game.
Yeah, it did, right? And I think, I pulled this book off the shelf and was like, oh, God, that's right. This book really started kind of a big movement in romance, and one in which I think played out not just in the way publishing worked and the kinds of books it put out and the kind of covers it put out, but in the kinds of stories people told, in the narrative choices that people made while telling them. I mean, I think that this is like a real...
Yeah.
Right? I think this book is terrific. I loved it. I loved rereading it. But I also think what happened after it is just as much as part of the story, but we don't know the ending of that story yet. We're still in it.
So I just want to shout out Sally's other books. Sally's last book was called 99% Mine. For those of you who like home renovation romance, that's that one for you. And she has a new book coming out called Second First Impressions that I have a galley of, but I haven't read.
And it's February, right?
Yeah, it's coming out in the spring. And yeah, I guess February is not the spring, but yes, February. And she lives in Australia. So she was here on tour for 99% Mine, but I guess it's COVID. So she probably won't be here on tour until at least later, right?
But I bet she'll do cool stuff online.
I bet she will. She's really fun. I did an event with her and Christina Lauren and Kennedy Ryan on Zoom a few weeks ago. We'll put that in show notes so you can watch. It's fun. She's the best. This is Fated Mates. What were you going to say?
Well, I would say our next read-along will be The Secret Diaries of Miss Miranda Cheever by Julia Quinn.
Because everyone is talking about Bridgertons. It's coming. Bridgertons, Julia, the Shonda Rhimes. If you live under a romance rock.
We do not.
Shonda Rhimes has acquired the rights to Julia Quinn's Bridgerton family. And the first season of her Netflix show drops Christmas Day. So if you are keeping safe and hanging out at home instead of seeing family, that's your gift, your Christmas gift, your holiday
gift.
That
and Wonder Woman 1984. I don't know which way I'm like, would spend a lot of time on the TV that day.
Yeah, same. And Eric was like, I would like a 4G TV for Christmas. And I said, okay, but surprise, the first thing we watch on it is going to be Bridgerton. Fair. Anyway, so, but Aaron and Clayton over at Learning the Tropes are doing a full Bridgerton series reread. So we decided that we would do my favorite Julia Quinn book, which is The Secret Diaries. And you can read that. That'll drop in 2 weeks. You have 2 weeks to read it. This week, tonight, Wednesday the 2nd, we are phone banking Georgia. Faded States is back. Or you can join us Saturday at 3 p.m. To postcard party with us, which will be also fun.
And we're going to record
we're going to record Faded Meets live. We haven't decided. It's going to be an interstitial, but we haven't decided the theme. That noise you're hearing in the background of my thing, if you're hearing it, is my dog chewing on a bone. And yeah. Okay, so the theme song is now going on and on, I bet. Our producer is Eric Mortensen. You can find us at fadedmates.net, where you'll find transcripts and merch links. Great for the holidays. Don't forget, this week is the last week to order the Faded Mates Best of 2020 pack from Old Town Books to get it in time for the holiday. I've heard from a few of you online. I heard from a husband who overheard. Oh, I can't tell. I can't. It's a secret. But anyway, yeah.
All right. We'll see you phone banking, or we'll see you next week, everybody. Happy December.